1939 is actually when the lightning bolt appeared first. I've looked back in my records and looked through much literature, and I cannot come up with the very first Cub that actually had the lightning bolt, but the 1939 models had a lightning bolt that originated on the boot cowl or fuselage cowl and terminated back on the vertical fin post underneath the tail. In 1946, mid-46, when Piper changed chemistry from nitrate to butyrate dope to facilitate manufacturing, they shortened the lightning bolt, and it began on the fabric, actually, just behind the metal boot cowl and terminated just under the leading edge of the horizontal stabilizer, excuse me. So it was a shorter lightning bolt, mm-hmm. and that began in late July of 1946.
So no real purpose for the lightning bolt. It just happened to be a design that they came up with.
Happened to be a design. I'm sure it was probably hard to do originally, but they had aluminum templates that they mm-hmm. put on the side of the fuselage and marked with a pencil. Of course, the J2, the previous to the J3, had three stripes back along the side, and probably took a little bit longer to mass three-quarter inch stripe. So the lightning bolt was probably more catchy and more of a trademark.
But, sure. It's definitely a trademark. No question about that. You know, we here in the United States take a lot of things for granted as far as being able to roll our airplane out of the hangar and just go fly on a nice evening like today. And I'm not quite so sure that that's the way it is in the United Kingdom, and of course in other places overseas. So Roger, could you give us an overview of the vintage Piper in particular, and I guess the J3 flying with actual antique and classic airplanes in the UK, just a brief overview?
Sure, if you're in the southern England at the moment, of course you can't fly at all because of the Olympics, because it's all shut down. So that's a very current topic. But basically, we've got several things against us. One being the weather, which is not so good. It's normally very windy in the UK, and that's not so good for a J3 Cub. We've got lots of regulations with not a lot of free airspace. So that's a little bit of an issue. I guess on the positive side, we do have something similar to the EAA called the LAA, the Light Aircraft Association, and most of the J3 Cubs are under that, where you can maintain your own aeroplane, for example, and it costs less to get it certified and approved each year. The lack of airports, even though we had a lot of World War II airports, a lot of those have been sold off for housing, and so the airports are getting less and less, and we have quite a lot of environmental issues about noise, even though the J3s don't make noise, other airplanes do make noise. So we do have a lot of things against us. And then finally, of course, the price of gas. I guess it's around $5 here. You're looking at, because we are in litres, and the equivalent is something like $12.50 for our gas, of which, just to let you know, 80% of it is tax. But we still enjoy our fabric pipers. There are actually what I would call about 350 vintage pipers still in the UK. It's more than 1,000 in Europe, and they're lovingly restored, as you saw in that picture of that L4.
That's good. That's good. Yeah, $12.50 would certainly, you'd be glad that you owned a Cub and not a DC-3.
Sure. Well, maybe the distances aren't so far in the UK, and so maybe you're not going so far, and that helps the rear end and the bladder, of course.
Sure. Sure. Well, Clyde, while we're talking about paint schemes, you know, there's always this controversy about what is true Cub yellow and so forth, and I noticed when I walk by all the J3s on the flight line, as I mentioned a little bit earlier, there's probably, what would you think, no fewer than maybe 100 different paint variations there, but tell us what the two primary ones are that that you're familiar with.
Well, the yellow, of course, was chosen, I think, for identity, similar to Caterpillar tractors were yellow. That maybe had something to do, and Model A Fords were black, and Model Ts, whatever. But Cub Yellow, or they called it Lock Haven Yellow, maybe not back then, but that name came about in the 50s. But the original vendors were Berry Brothers, Murphy, Glidden, and a company we know today as Randolph Products, Randolph Paint Company, actually started in 1932. Piper used them beginning in 1946. Randolph was the first company to supply butyrate dope, which came out during World War II. It was a little bit safer. It didn't burn like the nitrocellulose dope or nitrate dope that was used before. But during the days of nitrate dope, the yellow pigment that was in that was not the best. It was not a high solid color, and no matter what vendor supplied it, it was kind of a thin, translucent color. And of course, unlike nowadays, everybody that restores a Cub always paints a base coat of white before they put the yellow on, which enhances the brightness and vividness of the yellow. Back then, Piper didn't do that. That was an extra coat that wasn't necessary. So all airplanes had silver dope for UV protection. Of course, they didn't call it UV back then, but they did know what the sun did to the material, which was a very light weight of grade A cotton fabric. So over the silver dope, they sprayed this yellow nitrate, and even though all the colors in the can, nitrate and butyrate, when you took the lid off the can, they looked the same. It was the application, or just after application, the background caused the different shade. The pre-war color was a little bit darker because the yellow didn't cover the silver very well unless you put many coats on, which Mr. Piper would not have done. And in 1946, when Piper went to butyrate dope, the chemical of the butyrate was higher solids, better color retention, and it looked like the airplane was painted with a different coat or different shade of yellow, but it really wasn't. The yellow held its shade more, even though it was still painted over silver.
I see. Roger, we all know that the J3 Cub has made a significant impact on aviation. What other Piper aircraft do you think has made as significant a contribution to aviation?
That's a difficult one, but I guess I'd have to choose maybe two or three airplanes. The Piper Vagabond, the PA-15 Vagabond in 1947, is recognized as the plane that saved Piper. Piper were in terrible straits in 47. The banks had brought in Mr. Shriver and Shriver, and Mr. Piper was told to go on gardening leave, as we might say, and the two sons were sent on the road to sell Cubs. The factory said, what are we going to do with all these parts? Let's try and build a new plane, a side-by-side plane, shorter wing, first of the short wing Pipers, and that was the Vagabond. I mean, it looked like hell because it was no stripe. They made it as cheap as possible, and at least it sold and got Piper out of a hole. So I guess that the Vagabond is a pretty important Piper. Another important one, I guess, is the Super Cub. It sold well. It made over 10,000 of them, and it's still made today if you class the Cub Craft as top Cub, and still a very popular aeroplane, demands a very good price. The other significant aeroplane, I would say, is that when Piper changed from fabric to metal, they changed from high wing to low wing, from one engine to two engines, and that was the Piper Apache in 1953. That was a big change for Piper to come up with a business class aeroplane, and it was a great success. Such a good success, it was actually built on four different production lines at the Piper plant. So they would be my three.
Sure,
my
three.
There are many, many others I could come up with.
Well, along that same line, do you happen to know why Piper did not follow Cessna into the corporate jet world.
Well, that's a very long story. In 1969, a guy called Siegel, who just bought Chris Craft Boats, phoned up Mr. Piper and said, I'm going to buy your company, Mr. Piper Jr. And of course, the Pipers didn't want to sell. They had expanded so fast in the 60s, they actually owned only 40% of the shares. So they didn't have a controlling interest, but a big interest, but not a 50% interest. So they really didn't have total control of their company. So somebody trying to buy the other 60% would be able to take it over. They desperately looked around to find someone to help them, and they couldn't find anybody. So they sold out in the middle of 69 to Bangor Punter, big corporate. Chris Craft and Bangor Punter approximately owned half the company each. So there was quite some turmoil for the next number of years, where Chris Craft and Bangor Punter, who didn't particularly like each other, were running the Piper company. And the Pipers then were out of the picture. So first of all, there was turmoil in the ownership. The Pipers did not have enough money to design a jet themselves. They did look at a jet version of the Navajo. And so they said, well, the best we could probably do is buy a jet, an existing jet. So they looked at the Israeli 1121, originally the Aero Commander, but the Israeli jet. And in actual fact, they'd done a deal with the Israeli company to market that. They would get green aeroplanes over from Israel and paint them and finish them off in the USA for the USA market. They had actually signed that deal, and they also wanted to buy the aerospatial Corvette, the SN601 Corvette, but they didn't actually sign that deal. So the idea was that they would have two jets to sell in the in about 72, 73 timescale. They actually set up a jet organization. Two things then happened that they were developing the Cheyenne, the turbine Navajo, and that was taking up a lot of their resources to do. And secondly, there was a major flood at Lock Haven in June of 72 that just about wiped out the factory. 129 planes were lost, and numerous unfinished planes were lost as well. So basically, their concentration really was to put the factory back together again, and let's not worry about the jet because we've got too much other things to look at. And so they never did the jet.
I see. Clyde, I've had a J3 Cub for over 40 years now, and I guess when I was younger, I was probably a little bit more worried about how slow it went. And today, that kind of coincides with the way I am. But what if I were a 20-year-old and I owned a J3 Cub, and for some reason I wanted to make it go a little faster? Is there any way I could do that?
Yeah, there's several ways, Ron. Staying with the same engine, 65 horsepower, probably, I guess the cheapest, quickest way would be to go from a wood prop to a metal propeller. It's more efficient, harder on the engine and harder on the airframe because of harmonic vibrations. If you want to spend a little bit more money, you could do what Piper did when they came out with the next post-war model of the J3, the PA-11, and that would be to replace the wing lift struts with the low drag ratio type airfoil lift struts that began with the PA-11 and went on through the rest of the fabric Pipers up through the Tri-Pacer. And the third thing would be get rid of the leather bags covering the elastic shock cords on the landing gear suspension system. And they redesigned the shock strut assembly, still telescoping tube, but they put they redesigned the mechanism and put metal fairings over the shock cords, and that increased the speed about 8 miles an hour, just the struts and the landing gear. The metal propeller probably could add another 3 to 5 miles an hour with that. And of course, obviously going to a larger engine nowadays, which mm-hmm. a lot of people do,
sure.
Would do that, yeah.